listen as well. All right, Judy?
Yes, looks like some folks are still grabbing lunch. We are going to get started here. Next up, we are going to talk about employment, economic impact, and Dr. Roland Holst is here to take us to the next stage to think about after the operational costs and investment cost analyses are done, how we would take that data and translate and analyze the potential impact on California economy. So with that, David?
Thank you, Judy. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much for coming and sharing your insights and feedback with us. I'm going to talk about an assessment framework that I'll be doing with my very talented colleagues at Bayer. I've only got one representative here, Sam Evans, who may answer some technical questions, but I'll go over the general methodology myself. Now, when I schedule my economics classes at Berkeley, I normally try to avoid this time slot because of the sleepy effect, but I'll try to keep you animated if I can. We're going to go over the basic economic assessment methodologies, and we'll talk to some extent about the assumptions, but I want to try to make it clear what the kind of underlying drivers of our results will look like, subject to the inputs we get from our partners, Rattle, E3, and Aspen. We're near the end of our little pathway here. That's just our where are you diagram, but you'll hear about economics and environment separately. In terms of what I want to cover, I'm going to look at the sort of conceptual framework of income and job dynamics as they'll be affected by policies like this, and then talk about the model framework that we're using and the data. The economic data, that is, our system data and technical data will be coming from our partners. And then about the kind of output that we're going to be providing at the moment that we plan to provide. If you're particularly interested in other kinds of economic variables or impacts, we'd like to hear suggestions about that. And in particular, in terms of inputs from this audience, data sources, ideas about third-party data. We're always trying to find good data, particularly on with detailed models. And your own perspectives about where areas might be of greater policy interest, not just to us, but to other stakeholders. Then I'll talk about the basic issues of the economic assessment in terms of what economic variables we're going to be following, and what we think the underlying kind of systematic connections are. And then something about assumptions. Generally speaking, we're going to be looking at California, a very well-known market economy, so we don't have to assume too much, but we will talk a little bit about assumptions. Our basic objective is quite simple. I think this is a fundamental responsibility for any institution like ISO, and that is to promote evidence-based dialogue. We want to present evidence in order to make it easier to assess potential impact. Benefits, of course, everybody loves benefits, but in the case of other outcomes, we need to basically anticipate those, like adjustment assistance or mitigating activities. And the best way to do that is with ex-ante assessment. That's something that we're very interested in. Let me talk a little bit about the underlying drivers of income and job dynamics, because these are the two economic variables that will be of most general interest, I think, in the work that we're doing. There are three main pathways in the context of SB 350 that we'll be watching particularly closely. The first one is infrastructure investment, and by infrastructure I'm talking about energy transmission and capacity and transmission infrastructure. Sorry. Number two, power capacity investment. That would be new, incremental capacity or new capacity, maybe also some effects of retirement. And then finally, another category that often doesn't get enough attention, ex-ante, that is when people are thinking about big projects and big commitments to policy, and that is the effects on the fully dispersed population of ratepayers and electric power consumers. We want to watch that carefully because that is a momentous force. It's something that even though at the individual household level it may seem small, aggregates into relatively powerful economic drivers. And the potential for example, for ratepayer savings or incremental ratepayer costs could far outweigh some of those direct project effects of building transmission or generation capacity. Okay? In terms of estimating impact, I think for some of you this is familiar terrain, but I want to just explain that there are different pathways for economic impact, and we need to really take account of all of them. The first one are the direct effects. That's pretty obvious. If you build a new facility, then you're going to create jobs in the construction sector. You'll create jobs in engineering and other activities directly as a function of the project itself. Then there's a category of indirect effects, and these you can think of as supply chain effects, which are linked to the direct effects. So things like components, solar panels would be an example of that. Other windmills themselves would be an example of that in the renewables category. So these are essentially the first order supply chain linkages to the project. Those tend to be relatively widespread, but the effect on the economy depends on the level of import content in that case, right? If a project occurs in California, the direct effects will be primarily Californian. But the indirect effects may extend all the way across the Great Pacific Ocean to other countries. The induced effects are maybe more subtle, but as I suggested before, they can be very pervasive. And those are the effects of income linkages. First to the activity itself, that is the payrolls of people who are working in the direct and the indirectly affected groups. And there may be other induced effects as a result of changes in the underlying cost of the goods that are produced as a result of the project, in this case electric power. So those spending effects can be very widely dispersed through the economy, and they have a tendency, they're so-called multiplier effects, that can go across the full spectrum of goods and services. Here are a couple of principles that I want to emphasize without being pedantic, I hope. and just things that are fundamentally going to be related to this kind of assessment where we're looking at the energy sector. The first one is that infrastructure investment absolutely is a job creator. It's shovel ready if you're ready to invest, and it will create jobs on the spot. These tend to be relatively short-lived in terms of the actual build-out for projects like this. The second type of investment is capacity investment. This is for electric power, particularly in the renewable category. And this can create both short and long-term jobs for O&M and continuing electric service provision. But the job effects here, as I said before, are going to depend a little bit on the import content of the supply chain that deliver these technologies. And that's something we have to be a little bit careful about. As you know, there's been a big discussion about the reindustrialization of America with green energy. And as an economist, I have to look at that very carefully because we've seen new technology sectors emerge in the United States, but only certain kinds of jobs have been retained within the U.S. economy. Look at a company like Apple. You see the example. I mean, Apple essentially got the sweet part of the fruit in the design and the marketing jobs, but they essentially outsourced the core of the Apple, which is all of the manufacturing and production work. So we have to interpret that with care, and particularly in the context of California, because even if we have if we have domestic supply chains for some of these energy technologies, it doesn't mean that they're going to be inside of California. And this is something to watch closely because, for example, the NREL's really useful JEDI model is, as I understand it, calibrated to national supply chain data. So if you use NREL and you're trying to figure out what happens to California job creation, it could be quite misleading. You tend to overestimate the amount of job creation. But anyway, we're trying to be careful in these areas, and I'll talk about that in the context of our methodology. And then a third category, which I'm going to talk about in a little more detail in a second, is the concept of expenditure shifting. This is what happens when households have to pay a higher or a lower price for something they're already consuming. Think of gasoline. If you have to spend more at the gas pump, that's going to make it difficult for you to spend the same amount on other goods and services. If you save money at the gas pump, if you buy a fuel-efficient vehicle, you can take that dollar out of the gas pump and spend it on the stuff you really like, you know? And in California, 70% of that is services, right? We get two-thirds of our jobs by giving each other haircuts and espresso drinks in this state. That's a much more job-intensive pathway for expenditure, and I'll talk about that a little more in a second. But the last point, I think, is quite important in the context of equity, and this is something we understand pretty well about energy and other essential commodities. Lower-income groups have to spend a larger percent of their income on necessities like energy. And many of them actually don't have the option of choosing the technologies that use their energy. Their landlords decide what appliances they're going to buy, and they're not going to be buying innovative vehicle technologies anytime soon. You know that. So in this context, we have to see the affordable energy impacts, that is, rate benefits, as being essentially total. But let me get back to this issue of expenditure shifting. This is kind of a detailed diagram. I apologize for that, but it makes a very simple point, and it's an essential point to understand the expenditure effects. If what we have here are the 200 sectors in the bear model. Ordered, there are 200 separate sectors, from services to agriculture to production of manufacturers, and they're ordered by the so-called job intensity. Think of that as jobs per $1 million of revenue, right? How many jobs are created? And as you might imagine, the economy is very diverse by this metric, right? Some sectors are very job intensive, some sectors are not very job intensive. And in fact, the differences are so great that you need a logarithmic scale to actually capture it, right? Very big disparities in job intensity. So if you order these things, as I've done here, by less job intensive, more job intensive, then you'll see some general categories. And it turns out that the energy sectors are very low in job content on a $1 million per revenue per job basis, right? On the other hand, service sectors, not surprisingly, are much more job intensive. So let's go back to that gas pump and ask the question. If I have a fuel-efficient vehicle and I can pull a dollar out of the gas pump and spend it on the stuff I really want, what happens? Well, your expenditure essentially shifts from one sector to the other, and the net employment effect can be quite dramatic. Now, I'm not saying that all these sectors have the same wages by any means, but the wages don't differ by these kinds of magnitudes. These are orders of magnitude in terms of job creation. And it turns out that if you look at the oil and gas sector, the average consumer spending bundle in California, what economists call the market basket, is 16 times more job intensive than oil and gas. So if you can pull a dollar out of that gas pump and take it to Target, you're going to create a lot more employment in the state. And this is just something that we should recognize in terms of the way that expenditure is allocated by households. This turns out to be a very powerful driver, even for very small differences in real income. So it's something we have to keep an eye on. Let me talk about the overall modeling framework now, and then we'll try to pull those things together. Basically, the first thing is the bear model is a state model for the state of California. California's economy is absolutely unique. We all know that. That's for the reason why many of us live here, right? But you can't really use a national model or some generic macro model to capture the structural realities of this state economy. And our stakeholders in this state need very clear, precise information about any potential adjustment processes. Our policymakers need that too. So we want to be sure to use something that's essentially a native empirical tool. National and regional assessments they're convenient for looking at a larger universe geographically, but the problem is that they tend to average state results. So you can miss adjustment challenges that might arise and potential benefits. Secondly, with the dynamic model, so we basically look annually all the way up to 2030 and 2050. I'll talk about that in a second. But basically, we're trying to look at the pathways of growth, because the pathway is quite important, as we've learned from our studies of AB 32 and other environmental policies. We're looking at detailed interactions. This is a so-called general equilibrium model, so it tries to basically trace linkages across the economy, and that allows us to capture all of these effects, the direct effects, the indirect effects, and the induced effects. In many cases, you may have seen this in other impact assessments, the induced effects can far outweigh the direct effects. Even though a policy is normally motivated and driven forward by those who are directly affected, particularly in the context of environment and broad economic measures, indirect and induced effects can far outweigh direct effects. And finally, basically, we're trying to support ex-ante assessment of these policies rather than experimentation. The basic framework starts with this model, which we developed many years ago in support of AB 32, and have been updating regularly. It's called the Bear Model, named after our consultancy. And we're going to take in a very broad spectrum of economic data that we use for all of our forecasting work and add to that data from our partners, which has to do with the entire generation system, with costs, technical information about generation costs, rates, et cetera. So both E3 and Brattle are going to take responsibility for giving us most of the technical data on the energy sector, and we'll incorporate that so we have the most up-to-date information on the technology side. That we take and basically put into the model to generate macroeconomic effects, to generate detailed employment impacts, because as I said, we're interested in jobs, and we're not just interested in the aggregate in jobs. We're interested in the composition of jobs, because that would be very important to many stakeholder groups. And then we're going to use a more disaggregated approach, which I'll talk about in a second, to get to the disadvantaged community impacts. This is a category of stakeholders that basically requires much more specific attention, because it's a very heterogeneous group and more economically vulnerable group. So we'll try to disaggregate in a way that I'll talk about in a second to get to more detailed effects on those groups. Here's how we basically do the forecasting. First of all, there's a so-called general equilibrium model, which is just a big piece of software. It's a big forecasting model of the economy. And as I said, it's about 10 years old. We've been using it since the legislative run-up to AB 32. Then to that we add a technology module, which allows us to experiment with different types of innovation processes. We won't be using that directly this time, because the innovation information is going to be given to us by our partners. But it does allow for scenarios about learning curves and various kinds of innovation, of course, have been essential to the progress of the California economy. We have an electric generation and distribution model. It's not a dispatch model, but it does disaggregate the sources of energy. We have all the relevant categories of renewables, including both, or separately, utility scale and distributed solar, and other relevant renewable categories have been one component of the model. And then we have a transportation sector, which models the vehicle fleet. It's not like down to the level of the ants on the picnic table, but we do look at all the important categories of both new and used or pre-owned, I guess is the euphemism, vehicles. That's a big driver of forward electricity use, as you know, particularly under the relatively ambitious or optimistic assumptions about electric vehicle deployment that are built into our scenarios. In terms of time frame, the model runs from 2016 to 2030, and the kind of policy we'll be applying it to in this exercise. And then strategically, we go all the way up to the kind of endpoint for AB 32, just to follow the consequences of these intermediate policies. So we'll be focusing on the 2030 endpoint. In terms of economic data, our model basically is very disaggregated, very structural, and it has 200 production activities and commodities that are produced by those production activities. I think of like an input-output framework, but it's not a linear model. It's a much more complicated model. 24 different factors of production. The more interesting ones might be the labor categories. We have 22 different categories of labor that I'll talk about in just a second. We also have disaggregated households into decile income groups because, as I've said, we're kind of trying to be attentive to the distributional impact. And with policies such as energy policies, the distribution turns out to be quite important. And the effects tend to be heterogeneous. Enterprises at the moment are not very detailed, but we can break them down by a producer group, so we get the 200 sectors if we need that. We've got lots of fiscal accounts, because the state always takes an interest in big policies like this. So federal, state, and local fiscal accounts. And then the rest is basically about the savings and investment and trade within the U.S. and trade with the rest of the world. Okay. Now, the detailed occupations, I'm sorry about this slide. It looks like an eye exam, right? But I just want to mention, at least, at the moment, we're looking at 22 different occupational groups. Now, we could probably get by with less, or we also can go up to 95, but that's sort of overkill. But here's an area where stakeholder input could be quite valuable. If you've got a few favorite occupational categories that you're really interested in, make sure they're on this list, and if they're not, we'd like to see your feedback, because with 22, it's not clear that they're all of equal importance to us in terms of analysis. We just happen to have a consistent data set which allows us to capture this. But we'd be happy to focus in on other groups as well, as long as the thing doesn't grow out of control. And we understand that within the California economy, certain kinds of occupation groups are of more policy interest, shall we say, than others. But we're very agnostic about this aggregation, and we want to make sure that we shed light on areas that are of broadest interest to both the policy community and the stakeholder community. Okay, so feedback on this one would be especially welcome. In terms of our output, outputs, here's the basic macro story. We're going to look at employment in the aggregate, right? And we're going to look at employment by sector. Again, the 200 sectors in the economy. We'll look at households and household employment, because we can map that to the household level. We'll also look at these labor categories, and not just skilled and unskilled, but these 22 different labor categories. Then we're going to look at GSP, or gross state product. In the aggregate, this is value added, right, the amount of income generated by economic activity. And then we'll look at it also by sector. So lots of structural detail here. And then in terms of personal income, as I said, we'll have household income by decile, and also income and wages by occupation. And this is another thing to watch fairly closely. California has a fairly open labor market, especially at the border. So in that sense, wage adjustments are relatively smooth, but any policy of this significance would probably have some wage implications, so we'll, especially in the going out in the longer term. And then we can look at enterprise impacts, but also on state tax revenues. Now, in terms of the detailed livelihoods impacts, let me just touch on this. I know my time is running here, but I want to show you how we're going to try to get more information about economically vulnerable communities. We start with the basic bare model, which I pushed up in the corner here, and we're going to try to get down to impacts on disadvantaged communities, and at least we want to try to impute employment effects, wage effects, real household incomes, that's after adjusting for purchasing power changes, also consumption and household energy costs. So the way we get there is to start with our aggregate results from the bare model, and then we disaggregate those with the implant data. I'm not sure how many of you people know about this, but it's basically a national data set, which is also at the state level. At the state level, implant has county-level information. So we can use implant to get from our state model down to the county level for 58 counties in California. And that's the first step in disaggregation. And that we can bring all of our economic results down to that level, because the data in the bare model is relatively conformal to the implant data. Then we got to make the next jump to get to disadvantaged communities. And for that, we've got to do a little bit of more work. It's more intensive, but we're going to use econometric methods to exploit the fact that the disadvantaged communities are defined by census tracts. And the beauty of the census tracts is that we can bring up all this detailed demographic information and then match that to economic characteristics that we have at the county level. So we can essentially project, using the census tract information, we can project the county level data to more detail at the census tract level and identify economic outcomes for the disadvantaged communities. So that's the strategy. Essentially a two-step approach from the statewide model down to the county level and then over to the census tract level, where we can identify disadvantaged communities. And others, I mean, disadvantaged communities are essentially a mandate of state interest, and for very good reasons. But if you've got other types of spatial interests, then we're very open-minded about considering that, because we've got relatively high-resolution information here. Of course, there are resource constraints on this whole enterprise, but if you think that some spatial characteristics are of special significance, then please let us know. All right. And finally, the scenarios. You've heard about the scenarios. I don't have to remind you of what the scenarios are, but we've been over all. We'll be doing the same scenarios that you've heard about. Now, let me just summarize quickly. As I said, our primary objective here is to support dialogue with empirical evidence, and so we want to do the best job of that, of responsible, objective assessment. And as I said, I'm very agnostic about these outcomes, because I haven't even seen all the inputs yet, so I can't predict anything about the outcomes will be. I can tell you what drivers are important, and I've already done that. But we're reserving any judgment on this process. We simply want to try to provide rich and detailed enough data so we can capture the heterogeneity of these impacts, because they're always, the effects, the real effects of the policies like this are always quite variegated across the economy. I've gone over the basic intuition about drivers of income and job dynamics, but I'm happy to discuss them further. The model, data, scenarios, this will all be documented completely. Most of it has been already. And now it's time basically to talk more about stakeholder inputs. And my Q&A for the next 15 minutes, and also we've got an hour, I guess, reserved for that. But of greatest interest for our team, at least, is, as I said, any leads on what you think is better data? There's some very interesting labor data out there that could be incorporated, and we'd like to hear about the most available materials. Data from surveys on affected groups would be quite interesting. And then also areas of emphasis and that you think are a high priority, and assumptions, finally, assumptions. Yes, please.
Dave Marcus, consultant for Q. Mm-hmm. If you could back up one or two slides to the
That one.
One of the things that struck me looking at that is the red areas, which I assume are the lowest income.
Those are the ones that are defined as economically disadvantaged. Yeah.
Correlate surprisingly well to prospective solar development areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the difference between scenarios one and three that we heard this morning, mm-hmm. we've got something like 5,000 megawatts less renewable development in scenario three. Will your modeling look at whether the geographic location of what's in scenario one but not scenario three ties to those geographic areas?
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's a really interesting angle on the assessment, but I'm not aware that we're looking at siting issues for solar, are we? I mean, we don't have the capacity to answer your question specifically. Our model doesn't have the capacity to site the solar. We have a statewide energy sector. We differentiate the sources, but we don't locate them.
Yeah, just a comment here. We do have the location of where the portfolio would build the different types of renewables, not quite at this level of granularity, but we might be able to inform that question at least somewhat.
Yeah, so there could be some narrative about it. I mean, we can't evaluate it because our model doesn't identify the location of the internet. But there might be some narrative.
Well, I think if we know where the model would build the renewables, mm-hmm. We could probably correlate that effect, just construction-induced jobs to those regions, and then see how it overlays with the other effects that you measure in the model. Anyway, that's a good question. I'm not sure we've fully figured out how to close that loop, but I think we might be able to.
Yeah, I agree. It's an appealing insight about this.
And then following up on that, you had a very early slide showing the job intensity per dollar by sector.
Mm-hmm. And of consumption, right? Yeah.
When you're talking about that, and you had electric and power and construction specifically called out as, which dots they were.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about building new renewables, do you consider those as construction jobs
Electric
power
jobs? It depends on whether you're, I think in both the utility scale and the distributed case, there are jobs, and they could be classified as allied jobs to construction. I mean, certainly building a utility scale solar facility would be involve a lot of construction services. I don't know how labor wants to classify distributed solar, if it's like just installation, handyman, or if it's actually...
Distributed solar doesn't matter because in their scenarios, it's the same in every scenario. I'm talking about utility scale solar where there's thousands of megawatts of differences between scenarios.
That would be construction, absolutely, And that's the direct... No, there's no question about... Let me go back to that one really fast. And maybe it won't be so fast. Oh, rats, I wish there was like an express through all that stuff. But, the reason I included construction here is because the direct effects of both of the first two drivers, that is, building infrastructure and building capacity, the main direct effect would be right here, which is actually very favorable.
Not in electric power.
This is delivering electric power. This is post-project, right? Yes, these are electric services, electricity services, distribution services. Yeah, but this is construction, and that fits into the first two categories of drivers. That's why it's in the slide. Because it's like very conveniently, it's not even in the middle, again, because this is a logarithmic scale. It's much more labor intensive. So those are seen as quite good job creators. The only problem is how long they last. And another thing I didn't mention, but I should, about expenditure shifting is this is forever, folks. If you start saving money in a scenario has lower rates, for example, and you're saving money, those benefits compound like interest. They just go on and on. It's not like a one-time building project. But in any case, these are possibilities. And, of course, if rates were higher, it would have the opposite effect. You hear a giant sucking sound as people had to move money into electricity services. Yeah.
Yeah. Excuse me. Carl Sicello with NRDC. A couple of thoughts. One on the locational aspects of it we may not be capturing is the state has been involved with supporting and considering renewable energy zones in the Central Valley. San Joaquin Valley Solar Initiative has just recently been concluded, showing least conflict areas to develop solar in the San Joaquin Valley. And even though it won't be ready in time for your analysis, the Renewable Energy Transmission Initiative, also called
right,
ready,
right.
will likely have some new resource areas. I think you could assume that some of them would be in the San Joaquin. So I just wanted to point out that the correlation here is good.
Yeah.
Especially in a regional market construct where we can send power out. We may not be building more renewables for the overgen issue that you've identified, but if there's a market in neighboring states and a need driven by the Clean Power Plan to replace power at baseload facilities elsewhere in the West, we actually have a business proposition there. So just a thought there.
Right.
The second is, again, thinking about the San Joaquin Valley, that there have been a number of studies done about economic impacts of remediating air pollution in the Central Valley.
Yep.
And those by Fresno State University and California Endowment and others, I don't have the sites right in front of me, but they've done a number of studies that looked at things like worker productivity and reduced healthcare costs, mm-hmm. hospital admissions mm-hmm. and the like. I think that's really part of the value proposition if we're looking at reducing air pollution that's affecting the state, especially given that air pollution transport is part of the problem in the Central Valley and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So just a thought. There's a couple things we may not be capturing here that go to health effects and worker productivity mm-hmm. that are measurable and have been measured, at least in this part of the state, which is a disadvantage according to your map.
This is really welcome input. Yeah, thank you for both of those insights. I think our work, I'm talking for the economists only, is going to be frustrating to people who really understand the landscape of California, because this is just a thicket of legal and property rights issues, and we're sailing over the entire thing with a statewide model. But I think that if there are cost implications to that those kind of deployment, then they should be somehow reflected in our assumptions. You know, that there could be really significant potential costs for tie-ins, especially, right?
There's literature on this, too.
I can
point you right at it.
I agree. Yeah, I'm sorry that we just can't. It won't be seen. It won't be visible in our model, but it could be reflected in cost considerations. On the other issue of public health costs, we're not incorporating productivity or public health effects. But let's bear in mind that we're assuming that AB 32 is enforced throughout this whole thing. So that's in the baseline, and it's also in both the scenarios. Now, in fairness, though, they could have different criteria pollutants. Impacts, right? I mean, the GHG pathways are supposed to be the same, but the criteria pathways could be somewhat different.
But considering that many of the criteria pollutants from the power sector are going to be from the same exact sources.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Yes, please. I thought somebody back. Yes, please.
Okay. Hi. This is Sakita Grant from the Green Mining Institute. Thank you for your presentation. Two quick questions. On this slide, if you can explain a little bit better how you're downscaling based on county results, and
right.
then you are then doing the disadvantaged communities overlay. And if you can explain that again for me, just the importance of getting down to more granular than county level is really important for the disadvantaged
Absolutely.
Communities conversation. So just wanted to
make sure
that that you're capturing that within your study. And the second quick question is around whether you're able to capture undocumented laborers, day laborers, folks that, you know, might not be full-time or part-time with an actual company or organization, but are right, kind of right, not seen in those contexts.
Okay, on the first question, we really want to do a good job in that particular category, and we're, I'll tell you a little bit about how we're doing it without getting too technical, but we've got suggestions. We're very receptive to that. We always are looking for ways to upgrade our approach, but we're fortunate in the context of the disadvantaged community data because they're based on the census tract. And so we can extract from the census very detailed demographic information, and that would allow us to essentially disaggregate this and identify people in, with relatively detailed characteristics. So we're hopeful this will inform all the stakeholder groups that are interested in targeted demographics, if that answers your question partially. We're using an econometric technique called propensity score matching, but I don't have to talk about that right now. I'd be happy to do it with somebody outside. But the point is that the kind of data granularity, demographic granularity that you, I think, are suggesting is in the census tract. We're really lucky that the boundaries of the disadvantaged community classification are the same. So we're going to be able to take full advantage of that. In terms of formal and informal labor, that's obviously that's really tricky because we've got 11 million people walking around in the United States that aren't, are kind of invisible. You know, it's really hard to use official data, but we're trying to improve that with some data from Manuel Pastor at USC, who's got some really good data on informal labor. The only thing that we're finding right now is that it's a little hard to see the effects due to the scenarios. We can incorporate those categories, but we don't really see the informal-formal distinction being very sensitive to these energy policies, per se. But we're still looking into it, and we want to improve that dimension of the analysis.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to not belabor a point here, but I think David and Carl were onto something that's going to be fundamental to how this analysis will ultimately be used. And that gets back to the question I asked this morning about the assumption that solar energy is everywhere, we have nothing to worry about, we have plenty of it.
Yeah.
As someone who represents that industry, I'm not sure we see it quite that way, given some of these other constraints. And
sure.
So the point being is yes, the San Joaquin Valley does have significant potential associated with developing more utility-scale renewables. However, the planning process that is there now may result in, as the planning process did in the desert, of seriously restricting the amount of area that's really available for development, which will have an impact on employment, will have an impact on all these other things. Whether it's in the Bear model or one of the other models, this
yes.
needs to be looked at.
Yes.
Assuming
yes.
that solar is just, I get it, the sun comes up every day, we're blessed to live in California where it shines, but the fact of the matter is there's a lot of constraints on this that need to be looked at.
I agree with you, and I really hope that we can calibrate those things into our approach, but we're going to have to take a look at the cost implications of those kinds of the market segmentation, those barriers, the rights issues, all of that stuff. We should try to do it within the time and resources available.
Bill DiCapo, DiCapo Legal Advisors. Just a quick question relating back to going down to the census level.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be done, for example, consistently with what environmental justice analysis does? By using census tract information and methodology.
I don't really think I can speak for what environment, but we're talking about the same data set. I can tell you that, you know. But
there's a consistent methodology.
Yeah, I strive for comparability because I think it facilitates a rational dialogue, but I can only go so far. You know, I stop at the door that's labeled ideology. I never walk through that.
We'll be able to speak to the, when Aspen gets up, they can cover how they're going to approach the same question. And at the end of the day, obviously, we have to sync up the environmental and the economic analysis on each community. So.
Yes.
Mike Jaskey, Energy Commission. I'm trying to understand the completeness of this analysis. I can think of three effects of this whole proposition, you know, renewables built out of state as opposed to in-state. So you have less construction jobs in-state, you have less tax money on an ongoing basis in-state. You have negligible impact on permanent employment in the state because renewables have hardly any, you know, manning, staffing on a, you know, on an ongoing forward basis. So on the other hand, out-of-state location is going to have the construction job. They're going to have some increased tax revenue. and they may have a few, you know, ongoing permanent jobs, and perhaps more important, in a remote location in a small state like Wyoming or Idaho or whatever, than compared to the scale of California. Then you have the market side of things. So, you know, we have a bunch of people who are traders at 39 independent balancing authorities and maybe, you know, 50 or 75 actual utilities who aren't going to be doing so much bilateral trading. They're going to be shoveling data into the ISO scheduling process. And a bunch of, maybe there's some IT job differences. And then, you know, in the totality of all of that, there may be some rate effect in the total revenue, you know, stream differences between the business as usual and the high renewable out-of-state case, which your model will translate into all the things you described this afternoon. But how are you dealing with, or how is the ISO dealing with the fact that a whole lot of these effects are happening outside of California, not inside California? So if this analysis is restricted to what's going on inside California, it seems very incomplete.
Well, this is not a regional assessment, so that's the first thing to be very clear about. We've essentially drawn a line around the boundaries of the state of California, and we're not doing any economic assessment of job creation in Wyoming as a result of wind export. But that's just simply a decision in terms of the scope of the study. Having done that, then the differences in the scenarios are going to be primarily due to those three drivers, depending on which scenario you're talking about. In the scenarios that call for in-state capacity and transmission investments, we'll see job creation of the usual shovel-ready kind, right? In the case of a trading option that changes rates, I can tell you from experience in other states, in other contexts, I haven't seen any preliminary results because we don't have them, but we're literally talking about billions of dollars in rate payer differences. And if those turn out to be dividends, they will create a lot of jobs, I promise you that. I mean, absolutely. And most of these jobs are in the service sector. They're jobs that cannot be outsourced. They have much stronger in-state multipliers because the money is being spent essentially on local services. So these are effects that I think are discernible and quite important if they're of appropriate magnitude. And we don't know the magnitudes yet, I'm sorry, but we've committed to trying to assess the potential of those impacts because we suspect that they might be significant. We just have to wait and see. Other questions?
So, David,
yes.
I'm going to check the phone lines first. And I think what we're going to do, instead of taking a break, since we sort of just returned from lunch, we'll go ahead and have Aspen present, and then we'll take a short break, and then we'll come back and have the deeper discussion. So, Tim, are there any questions in the queue?
At this time, there are no callers in the queue.
They all fell asleep.
Okay. So we'll invite Aspen up to speak.